The Hayes Advantage with Kathleen Hayes and Vonnie Quinn.
Nothing wrong with having $49 million. Good for you, John Paulson. But the author of a book that we are looking at now certainly says that inequality in this country, economic inequality, is something that endangers our future. I'm talking about Joseph Stiglitz, of course, Columbia University professor of economics, winner of the Nobel Prize in economics, the author of several books, and this latest book is The Price of Inequality. We sat down and talked to him at length. We're going to spend the next hour with this interview. We asked him just how pronounced income inequality is now, how it compares to 20 or even 30 years ago.
Today, the United States has the highest level of inequality of any of the advanced industrial countries. There are various measures of inequality. One simple statistic that I think is quite interesting is the fraction of the income that goes to the top 1%. It's a measure of inequality focusing on the very top. And that number today is around one-fifth, 20%. And that's about twice what it was in 1980. Even worse is the fraction of the income that goes to the upper 0.1%, one-tenth of 1%. That's tripled over the last 30 years. So inequality in the United States has been growing, and no matter how you measure. If you look at inequality of wealth, it's even worse. The top 1% has about 40% of all the wealth. And again, in the Great Recession, things got much, much worse because the banks had engaged a lot of predatory lending, lent to a lot of people beyond their ability to pay, so that the people at the bottom who were aspiring to join the middle class saw their wealth devastated. They had all their wealth in housing. Housing prices have gone down on average in the country 30%, and so they lost everything.
Could you give us a very little potted history of how we got to where we are so fast? You said 30 years, there was a doubling. How did it get so bad and so quickly?
Well, there are a number of factors. When we talk about inequality, we need to distinguish between the before-tax and transfer distribution and the after-tax tax and transfer situation. And what's interesting is that there has been an increase in the before-tax inequality, and the government has been correcting it less, so that both parts are important. Now, the second is easier to understand. Beginning with Reagan, we lowered the degree of progressivity. That is to say, we lowered the taxes at the top much more than we did in the middle and the bottom. The result of that is apparent. The people at the very top pay a lower rate than those in the who have incomes that are substantially lower.
Are you talking about effective rate, Joe, or the statute rate?
Well, both, because what happened was the people at the very top get a very large fraction of their income in the form of capital gains. And the statutory rate on capital gains is much less. It's 15%. And if you earned your income rather than got your income for speculation, you'd be paying 35% of your income. Now, of course, it's even worse than that, because when you get income in the form of capital gains, you only pay the tax at when you sell your assets. So you can postpone the tax, and that's another tax break. And if you should die, it turns out that you can pass your assets on to your children. There is what is called a step of a basis, so they don't pay any capital gains tax. So you can totally escape paying taxes on those capital gains. And what is so clever is that people at the very top have figured out how to label income that ought to be ordinary income as capital gain.
Well, what do you say to the argument that rectifying the tax system, so making people that earn more pay more in taxes and sort of equalizing the burden of taxes around society, that wouldn't help very much anyway, and that it's not the gap we should be looking at now, but from this position, we should just be concentrating on the poor. We are where we are now.
Well, one of the characteristics about America's inequality is it's manifested in every part. We have the top of receiving a larger and larger fraction. The middle is being hollowed out, and there are more and more people in poverty. And so what I argued in my book, The Price of Inequality, is that we have to attack all three of these. Now, what is true is that some of the policies aimed at one may not be the appropriate policies, or may not do much in the other category, but some of them will. For instance, one of the sources of wealth at the top, income at the top, it results from the financial sector's practices, predatory lending, abusive credit card practices, all the things that we saw in the run-up to the crisis, where the financial sector wound up with 40% of all corporate profits. Much of that income was a result of taking advantage of the people at the bottom and the middle. So that was a transfer of income from the bottom and the middle to the top. So that if we could stop that, we would reduce the incomes at the top, and we would have more income of those at the bottom and the middle.
That many would agree that the tax system, and particularly the corporate tax system, is in need of reform. And I would think that even some people in corporations would agree. It's onerous on them to be in a system that is so controlled by the lawmakers, so that you have to employ lobbyists, right? You get a tax break for Joe Stiglitz Enterprises, so Kathleen Hayes Enterprises has to pay her lobbyist to get a similar break. It'd be much simpler level playing field. Don't have it played that way. But, you know, quite apart from the corporations, this seems to be something that is coming from the lawmakers who are so subjected and so influenced by the money in the game.
One of the important points I make in the book is that a lot of the money at the top is a result of what economists call rent seeking, this kind of looking for special benefits from the government, either in the form of largesse, in the form of encouraging the government to pay too much for what it buys, like in the case of drugs, or to give away things, to sell things at too low a price, which it does, say, in the case of minerals. And one of the important points I make is that getting rid of this rank-seeking would actually increase the efficiency of the economy and lower inequality. So we used to think that there was a trade-off. We could only get less inequality by giving up on growth and efficiency. But once we understand the source of much of the inequality in the United States, we realize that we could have a more equal society and a more efficient economy.
I want to start with transferring wealth and transferring from haves to have-nots. We're seeing the same problem in Europe. Germany is the have, and you know, many of the peripheral countries are the have-nots. How do you do that successfully? Can it be done?
Yes, clearly it can be done. The countries in Europe that are doing the best are the Scandinavian countries, the Nordic countries, and they have the strongest system of safety net, social protection, strong investments in education. We were talking before in terms of the sources of inequality that I discuss in my book, The Price of Inequality. We were talking about the sources of before tax inequality. And one of the problems in the United States is that we have become a country which has the least equality of opportunity of any of the advanced industrial countries.
The least equality of opportunity.
Yes, very different from our image of ourselves. We think of ourselves as a land of opportunity. And we can all think of examples of people who've made it from the bottom to the middle, the bottom to the top. But what matters is not these unusual examples, but what are the life chances? What are the probabilities? What is the likelihood? And if you look at the data, the statistics, the fact is that the life chances of somebody in the United States is much more dependent on the income or education of his parent than in old Europe or in the other.
But there's so much that you hear and read about Europe and how the labor system is so stratified and controlled. If you have to have a license to be a certain kind of journalist in France, and then it's very difficult to change jobs. We hear so much about that. So you might say there's the opportunity, but practically it's very difficult to change careers, change jobs, move around.
Well, let me be clear that they don't have perfect mobility. But the real question we're focusing on here is, what are the chances of somebody who was born at the bottom making it to the middle, or the chance of somebody born at the bottom making it to the top? And that depends to a very large extent on education. And they've done work very hard in Europe to make sure that everybody has access to a good quality education, regardless of the income or education of your parents, where you live. Whereas in the United States, we've created a system where if your parents are well off, you live in a nice, good suburb, you go to a good school, you can afford a good private education, and then you get into one of the elite schools, and then you do very well. You're set for life. But the fact is that even though our elite schools say, you know, needs blind admission, only 8% of those in the elite schools come from the bottom 50%. The fact is, if you are in the bottom 50%, your chances of making it to the top are much lower.
How do you beat that system then? Do you do what Peter Thiel says of PayPal and not go to college at all? Do you take on a couple of hundred grand's worth of student debt? Or does the United States really need to do something fast about its education system?
I think we have to do something fast about our education system. And what troubles me is that in the response to the economic downturn, we're cutting back on public education. Just a report coming in from California is that with their budget stringency, if they don't pass this extra referendum on more support, one of the country's premier public higher education system is going to have to be cut back. And that's going to mean even less opportunity. Because one of the things that we've discovered in the last 10 years is the for-profit schools that we've been relying on more and more have actually been cheating to a very large extent the poor people who've come to depend on them. And the result of this is increasing indebtedness. The average college graduate now has $25,000 of debt. And if they don't get a quality education, they won't get a job. And we passed a bankruptcy law that said you can't discharge that debt even if you go into bankruptcy. So it's a lifelong chain around their neck.
You know, in your book, one of the chapters, Justice for All, How Inequality is Eroding the Rule of Law, and of course we're talking about The Price of Inequality by Joe Stiglitz, How Today's Divided Society Endangers Our Future. And you focus on a couple of things, but one of them is Chapter 9, A Macroeconomic Policy and a Central Bank by and for the 1%. Now, I'll bet if Ben Bernanke were here, he'd say, he would disagree. He'd say, no, we're trying to stabilize the economy. We're trying to, keep financial stability. We do that for everybody, Joe. We don't just do it for the 1%. What is your argument?
Well, the thing I try to point out is that to a very large extent, the Federal Reserve is also cognitively captured by the banks. That it, especially the big banks in New York, and it begins to think like them. So I do believe that their intent, they believe that they're serving the interests of the entire country. But let's go back before the crisis. Ned Gramlich, others saw the need for more regulation of the banks, that they were making all these bad loans, they were engaged in predatory lending, they were engaged in discriminatory lending, they were targeting Afro-Americans, Hispanics, people who had never bought a house. Some of the banks have paid large fines in settlement of these accusations. So these are not just fantasies. These are real, you know, we have lots of evidence on this. The Fed refused to do anything about it. They could. The Congress gave them the power in 1994 to regulate what was going on. They refused. Why? They said, oh, let the free market take care of it. So they effectively supported these kinds of policies by not doing anything about it. More recently, in the discussion of the Dodd-Frank bill, Blanche Lincoln, the head of the Senate committee, said, we ought to make banks go back to doing what they're supposed to do, lending money that will create jobs, lead to more investment. they shouldn't be engaged in these risky derivatives, betting on whether Greece is going to collapse, whether euro is going to collapse. You know, that's not part of the business of banking. We need money for lending. And that was what the president came when he came to the American people and said, we need to give money to the banks, not because we love them, because we want them to lend. Well, she proposed that. And what happened? The Fed said, oh, that would be terrible. Interestingly, two of the governors, the regional governors, Hunnic and Fisher, said, no, we want our banks to go back to basic banking. But Bernanke sided with the big banks that were making estimated $20 billion in trading derivatives. I understand why they wanted to continue doing that. But as the regulator, he should have sided, like Fisher, like Hunnic, on the interest of the American firms that need that money.
Another topic you address when you talk about how inequality is also undermining, eroding justice for all in this country, the battle of the budget, austerity versus stimulus. What is the key argument there?
The key argument is that if we really were having a battle of the budget about fiscal responsibility, we would begin by recognizing that just a decade ago, we had a surplus. In fact, the surplus was so large that Alan Greenspan said we had to have a tax cut, because if we didn't have that tax cut, we would pay back the entire national debt and he wouldn't be able to manage monetary policy. Now, you have to admit that was a little bit of a strange argument, because if what he feared had come to pass and we were running out, we were under threat of having paid back the total national debt, I believe that if he went to Congress and said, you have to spend a little bit more so we can have a little bit more national debt so that we can run monetary policy, Congress would have obliged. That's, by the way, an example of how the Fed, Greenspan, was not reflecting the realities, but really advocating a policy that was supportive of a tax cut for the rich. So if we begin from that perspective, we realize that it's very easy to solve our budgetary problems. Just figure out how we went from this 2% of GDP surplus to where we are today.
Well, we had a stock market bubble, a tech bubble in the late 90s that threw off all kinds of tax receipts. That's part of the reason we ended up with a surplus.
There were four things that contributed most to converting our surplus into a deficit. A tax cut for the very top and two wars that were very expensive, an increase in defense expenditure that went well beyond those two wars. Drug benefit, which included a provision that we wouldn't negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies, and that cost us an estimated, by some accounts, $500 billion over 10 years. And most importantly, the economic downturn. The economic downturn was not caused by the deficit. The deficit was caused by the economic downturn. So if we put Americans back to work, that will do more to reducing the deficit than anything else. Austerity will make things worse.
The United States, is it undergoing a structural transformation right now? Is that the cause of the pain more than anything else? And if so, what is the next incarnation of the United States going to look like?
Well, the U.S. has to go through a structural transformation. One of the things, we're a victim of our own success. Productivity in manufacturing has gone up, and we've helped globalize the economy. And the result of those is that we globally, employment in manufacturing is going down, and our share of that decreasing employment is going down. So we have to move into other sectors, particularly the service sector, and not banking. And because of the way the Fed allowed the bubble to grow, we've overinvested in real estate, and so we're going to have less construction. So these are the realities. So we have to change the structure of our economy into other areas like education and perhaps health. And that's going to need government support, active labor market policies. What worries me is that cutbacks by the government are going to make things even worse. In the Great Depression, we were also going through a period of structural transformation from agriculture to manufacturing. It was only through World War II, large fiscal spending, which at the same time restructured our economy, moved people from agriculture to industry.
How do you justify stimulus to the size that you say is needed, though, in peacetime? And how do you get Congress to agree on something like that?
Well, fortunately, we don't need the size of stimulus that we had in the Great Depression. One of the ways you point out is that we've underinvested in our country. We've underinvested in education. We've underinvested in technology. We've underinvested, most importantly, in infrastructure. If you look at a country through the perspective of a balance sheet, yes, if you borrow, your debt goes up. But if you use those funds to invest, your assets go up. And if you invest well in lots of good investments, the wealth of the country is even larger. So if you understand these basic economics, it's a way to make our country stronger, not weaker.
We also have a relatively high debt-to-GDP ratio right now, and we know that financial markets investors are growing more and more fearful of countries with high debt-to-GDP ratios every day in the midst of the European debt crisis. So while many people might agree with you, yeah, we need more investment, they'd say, yeah, but the problem is right now, you know, we should have done this when we had the low deficit, even the surplus, and that's why they say, Joe, it sounds good, but you can't do it.
Oh, well, that's wrong. The markets right now are willing to lend to the United States at zero interest rates short, less than 2% long. The markets believe, I think correctly, that we're a good bet. But we're only a good bet if we invest in our future. So we can borrow at very low interest rates, get a lot higher returns than the cost of capital. If a firm could borrow at those low interest rates and get those high returns that have been proven for our investments, for instance, in technology, they would say it's foolish, it's stupid not to do it. And if we look at our nation as a whole, we are being foolish not to do this.
What about immediate stimulus? Is there something that could be done right now? Or, as Simon Johnson from MIT Sloan School of Management told us in a recent interview, it's going to take time. Quantitative easing by the Federal Reserve, interest rates are already so low. Not much the Fed can do with more operations like that. We had a balance sheet recession, a bank-led balance sheet recession. It just takes time to deleverage, to work this off. And there really isn't a fiscal-type stimulus that would help. Do you see anything that right now would help?
Yes, I do. I agree with Simon that there's very little scope for monetary policy. QE2 didn't work very much. QE3 is not going to work. That's why I think a fiscal stimulus of the kind I described, focused on investment, would actually help the economy significantly.
Now? Right now.
Just to give you one aspect, I emphasize investments in education. So important for increasing equality of opportunity where America is doing so poorly. The problem is that the states don't have any revenue, and the states are constrained by a balanced budget framework. So as we're talking now about the problem of lack of equality of opportunity, lack of competitiveness of America, states throughout the country are cutting back on education. It makes absolutely no sense. So what we need is some kind of revenue sharing program where the federal government gives money to the states. The states have their fiscal situation is not caused by any mistake that they've made, because the federal government, including the Fed, mismanaged the macroeconomy. The economy has gone into recession and their revenues go down and they have no choice but to cut back.
Companies, Professor, how do we persuade U.S. companies to invest? I mean, the amount of cash that's on companies' balance sheets and they are just not deploying it, don't they have a responsibility as well?
I think they do have a responsibility, but as we all know, incentives matter. And my view is you ought to use tax policy to provide those incentives. So the way you do that is you lower taxes, corporate taxes, on those firms that do invest and do create jobs, and you raise taxes on those firms that are not investing in America, that are not creating jobs in America. So you use the tax system to get rid of those corporate welfare from which none of us benefit, but to encourage investments from which all of us will benefit.
Well, we had front row seats when we sat down with Joseph Stiglitz. I'm Kathleen Hayes. Bonnie Quinn and I talked to him at length, this professor of economics at Columbia University, this Nobel Prize winner, author of yet another book, The Price of Inequality, How Today's Divided Society Endangers Our Future. Let's get back to that conversation. How big of a threat to the United States is the European debt crisis?
Well, the European debt crisis can affect us through two channels. One, our financial systems are very interdependent. And secondly, Europe is one of our trading partners. Now, the effects through the financial sector are not certain. One of the things that became so clear in the crisis of 2008-09 was that our financial system is not transparent. And many of us had hoped that the Dodd-Frank bill would make it more transparent, but it clearly failed, as the problems with J.P. Morgan make so abundantly clear. We allow these non-transparent derivatives, CDSs, to continue. So we simply don't know. But I think most people conjecture that the interdependence, the intertwining of the financial systems is sufficiently great that it would have significant impacts through that channel on the U.S. But Europe is one of our most important trading partners, and a marked slowdown in Europe would inevitably hurt the United States. Remember, a couple years ago, President Obama said that recognizing the difficulties of getting consumption going, getting construction going, was that he hoped that we would be able to export our way out of this crisis. Well, if Europe goes into a downturn, that's not going to happen.
You recently cheered the election of François Hollande in France. Does Europe need more governments with socialist leanings? And if so, then why aren't the populists electing them?
Well, they have elected them in France, and the left did quite well, actually, in Greece. One of the things that's going on in the politics of Europe is dissatisfaction. And whoever is the incumbent is being thrown out. Part of the reason is they are blaming whoever is in office for the downturn, when in fact, there are global conditions. Obama inherited an economy that was in wreck. So he is being blamed for the mess that Bush created. Now, he may not have done as much as he should have done to address the problems, but he did so much more than Bush even contemplated doing. So it's ironic to blame Obama for a problem that was created by President Bush. And yet, that's what voters in country after country are doing. They say, whoever's in government failed to get to resuscitate the economy, whether he's on the left or the right, we're going to throw them out and give somebody else a chance. And, you know, Spain is a wonderful example of this. Zapatero didn't cause the crisis. He was almost powerless to do much about it. He followed the austerity approach, which the right was advocating. They threw him out. The new government came in. Things have gotten even worse. Unemployment among the youth now in Spain is over 50%. And so people are now frustrated. And in the last elections in Spain, the local elections, they voted against the party that they had just elected. So what is clear is a level of frustration, and the real danger here of not getting this right is extremists are growing. Especially the extremists on the right.
Well, is there a chance or not that the euro can hold together? There are a number of Wall Street analysts, academics, policymakers still betting that somehow the eurozone leaders can do something, even though they have not been able to take a real dramatic step yet. Others are saying, look, it's not even about steps. It's about a zone that encompasses a very low productivity country like Greece, a very high productivity like Germany, which on top of everything else, Germany running the tightest monetary policy possible, then the whole European bloc has to follow that. Someone say the economics just don't add up. The eurozone is a contradiction, an economic and financial contradiction at its core, and it can't hold together. What does Joe Stiglitz say?
I'm somewhat sympathetic with the view that the euro area is not an optimal currency area, that it's extraordinarily difficult to make this thing work. I do think that if they have enough political will, they could make it work. We have a lot of differences between the various parts of the United States, and we've made a single currency work, but we've done it because we have a high degree of fiscal consolidation. When California has a problem, we don't ask California to bail out its banks. The federal government does. If California has high unemployment, some of the unemployment costs are borne by the federal government. So we have a kind of federal system where the federal government provides a lot of assistance to any part of the country that's having difficulty. Now, Europe hasn't gotten there. So they had they took away two of the most important instruments of adjustment, the exchange rate and the interest rate, and they didn't put anything in its place. They didn't go to have a single banking regulator and a single banking authority, a deposit insurance. The result of that is when you have a problem like in Spain, money leaves Spain, they can still be in euros, and move to Germany. And that run on the Spanish currency, or JOG as some people have called it, means that the Spanish economy is getting weaker, weakening the ability of Spain to help its banks, and it's a downward vicious circle. So they have to make very big institutional changes. Can they do it? So far, they've shown no ability to do it.
Many thanks to Joseph Stiglitz. His new book, you definitely want to take a look. It's called The Price of Inequality, How Today's Divided Society Endangers Our Future. Thanks to Joe, Nobel Prize winner, professor of economics at Columbia University.
You can listen to The Hayes Advantage weekdays at 12:30 Eastern on Bloomberg 1130 in New York or on Sirius and XM Satellite Radio Channel 113. Copyright 2012, Bloomberg LP.